Hi there, we really hope you enjoy this teaching from the Message Trust. To find out more about all the exciting things we're doing, check out our website, message.org.uk.
Thanks, what an absolute privilege it's been to be with you guys. I would join you if I could. Trust me when I say that, I'm telling you the truth. It's beautiful. If I could speak for the founders of the Salvation Army, which I probably can't, but if I could, I'm pretty darn sure they would be super proud of what you're up to and what you're doing in the world. It's beautiful, beautiful work that you're doing. Years ago, I went. I had the privilege of going to Russia with the Salvation Army to reopen it after the Soviet Union collapsed, and the church was invited back in. And I got to serve with a guy I affectionately call Captain America. And the reason I call him that is because he was American, and also because he was a captain. Those are two subtle things. But also, Captain America, as I affectionately call him, he was impressive. He was like 6'2", you know, 3. He was commanding. He was chiseled. You know, he was like the kind of guy. I mean, he was just a really good looking guy. He was super charismatic. I mean, he had all sort of the skills of a great leader. You know, when he entered a room, as a matter of fact, you can imagine the 6'2", sort of chiseled, good looking, charismatic guy in a uniform walking into a room, and he was just in charge. You know, like he could do stuff. I mean, before he joined the Salvation Army, he was owned his own airline. So he was like he was used to getting stuff done. And so he had arranged all these incredible things. It was amazing to serve under him. And he had actually convinced the American military, because they had stored three tons of B-rationed soldier food in the first Iraq war in the Iraq Gulf there. And that war didn't last very long. Remember? So they had 3 tons of leftover B-rationed soldier food that they didn't know what to do with. The Americans were thinking, we'll just dump it in the ocean. No one will know, you know. And this guy convinced the American military to donate it to the Salvation Army in Russia so we could distribute this food all over Moscow. And at the same time, he got Boris Yeltsin to declare the Salvation Army the official social services agency of Moscow, which included an office in the Kremlin. Now, yeah, he's a little impressive, right? Like, this guy's like some serious stuff. So we're like driving to the Kremlin for work, you know, and by the Salvation Army, what of course that in reality was that Captain America and his wife, Mrs. America, and me. And I was like 19-year-old juvenile delinquent, right? Just like out of, freshly off probation. So, that was the Salvation Army in Moscow, you know, and we witnessed all this stuff. Now, he had to go back to him. He had to do this homeland furlough for a couple months. He was going back to America, and in the Salvation Army was sending a replacement in for him, and they just kind of called me up and said, would you stay, because you're like kind of the person that drives the car and like gets all the bags, so you know what's kind of going on. You're like the real deal. So could you stay and kind of help this transition while Captain America's in America raising some money? And I said, sure, yeah, that'd be great. So I remember remember it so clearly, picking up his replacement. Captain America goes off to America, and I go to the airport to pick up this person the Salvation Army sent to replace him, and I watched in horror as this like retired, shriveled Swedish lady in a uniform, you know, gets off the plane. And I just remember in my heart going like, what is wrong with the Salvation Army, you know, which is a question I've asked every day since. But you know, like, what is going, like, and I remember her coming, she's the nicest, sweetest lady, you know, coming over to me, and she just said, oh dear, so nice to meet you, you know, you must be Danielle, and I was just like, we're gonna die. You know, like, wait, that's it, it's over, we're dead in the water, you know, like, what is happening? Then the next day I went to pick her up, I said, we've got a really important day planned tomorrow, we can't really miss it, because what we were doing is we had gotten all this donation of food and also light bulbs, which was a big find, and we were taking them into this secret prison in the inner city of Moscow. It was a famous, infamous, and secret place, and no one could get in there except us. They actually hadn't had light bulbs in this prison for 10 years. They were literally prisoners in the dark. And we were literally bringing the light. It was so cool. And because nobody could get in here except the Salvation Army because of Captain America, he had brokered a deal with Time Magazine and Newsweek that they could accompany us on our trip because it was the only way they were going to get on the inside of this prison. So I went and picked up Time Magazine, a Newsweek reporter, you know, and then I went and I got all these light bulbs and all this stuff. And then I went and got Commissioner Ingrid Lindberg, the retired Swedish lady. God bless her. And I pick her up and we're driving to this prison. And while we're driving to this prison, I don't know if you've spent much time with reporters or American reporters, but they are little tiny but cynical. And they're in the back seat and they're talking to each other and they're just going, we can't wait to get in here and expose all this injustice. And we heard this warden, you know, and they're just like going on and on about how they're just going to like totally, kill this warden and expose sort of the terribleness of the Soviet system. And, I remember Commissioner Ingrid Lindbergh, she leaned over to me. I was driving and she said, excuse me, Danielle, would you mind pulling the car over? And I'm thinking to myself, like, what, does she have to pee? Right? Like, how low are we going to go here? You know what I mean? Like, retired women, yikes. So I was like, sure, you know, whatever you say. I mean, I'm in the Army. She's a commissioner. So I pull the car over, and she turns around to these guys, and she says, you know, I couldn't help but overhear your conversation. And they're like, uh-huh. And she said, I feel like something inside me feels like you might not have been briefed on this mission. And they said, well, what? And she said, well, see, the thing about the Salvation Army, she said, is like our mission is actually to bring good news. Like our mission actually in this prison is to actually bring good news. And I spoke to the warden this morning. I called ahead of time and I assured him that we were actually coming in a spirit of love. And we were coming in a spirit of the gospel. And we were coming in a spirit to minister to him. And it feels like you're not quite briefed on that mission. And she said, so I just wanted to give you one more opportunity before we get to the prison, if you're not on board with the mission of the Salvation Army, to get out of the car. Boom. I remember thinking to myself, like, we're dead. I'm just like, is Time Magazine, can you imagine the reports the next day, you know, Salvation Army officer strands Time Magazine reporter on the side of the highway in Russia, right? Like, I was like, forget exposing the Soviets, now we're exposed, you know, like, I was just like, what are you, like, a maniac? Like, have you lost your mind, you know? And then I saw that these guys just went all apologetic. They were just like, oh, no, sorry, we're on board, we're on board. They said, no, we're on board, you know, they just changed their tune. And then she said these words, although I remember it, actually, after a couple months with her, these were magic words. She just said, actually, I think we should pray. Now I'm thinking, she's praying out loud with Time Magazine and Newsweek, like, in the name of Jesus, what is she thinking? It'll be the end of our PR campaign, you know. And she just began to pray, and when she prayed, the Holy Spirit filled the van. I've never seen two more adult, male, cynical journalists turn into little boys. You know, I mean, literally, they just turned six. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Okay, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. And then we went to this prison, and I'll never forget it. It was so hilarious. This Time Magazine, you know, is tapping Commissioner on the shoulder. You know, Commissioner, do you think it would be okay if I took a picture of that over there? You know, like, Commissioner, do you think it'd be all right if I interviewed this person over here? Commissioner, do you think? And then that night, when we got back to the, it was a beautiful day at the prison, incredibly beautiful, spirit moving. And when we got back to the office, I got this fax, you know, and that tells you the time. I got this fax, and on the top of the fax, it was the report of the Time Magazine. It was the Time Magazine reporter sending his, what he was going to write to Time Magazine. And on the top, he had written, for the commissioner's approval. I said, well, who made the commissioner the editor of Time Magazine? Like, what is going on here? The next morning, he was going out of town, that guy, and he came by and he said, do you think she would see me? I said, I'm sure she'd make some time in her very busy and important schedule, you know. And he came into the office and said, look, I got to leave town, but I wondered if you might pray for me again. I want more of that. You know, it was in that moment, it was in that season of my life that God showed me something so key and so very important about leadership, about what kind of a leader I wanted to be, what kind of a leader I would choose to be, and what kind of a leader God would choose to use so powerfully for his kingdom purposes. And I think sometimes when we're doing this kingdom business, there are some keys, you know, kingdom keys to do it God's way. And it is so tempting in our world, and it's so hard to resist the world's ways. It really is. It's so hard to resist the things that we can see and how we feel good about ourselves and what we kind of know about stuff. It's so hard to resist those things for what God's strategy is. But God has a specific strategy that he wants to use. And there's a couple keys that God taught me, and I wanted to just give them to you because I think they're kind of foundational. They're foundational things that have helped me in my life to stay rooted and established in what kind of a person and what kind of a leader I want to be. They're also found in the life of Gideon. And I actually think Gideon is a prototype leader for you guys. I think Gideon, you know, the smallest and the least and the grittiest and the one that sort of, but actually the one that God uses so powerfully as a mighty warrior. So if you have your Bibles, I'd love for you to turn to Judges chapter 6. And it's kind of Gideon's call. Many of you will be super familiar to this, but there's just kind of two principles I want to share that have been so helpful to me in my life in terms of grounding me. You know the story, if you've watched A Bug's Life, it's all very clear. Pixar should really be paying somebody something for that storyline. But Israel, again, is oppressed by the Midianites, Boo Hiss, and they cry out to the Lord because of Midian. And the Lord sent a prophet to the Israelites, and he says, this is why this has all happened. It's basically your fault. And then the angel of the Lord comes and sits beneath the great tree at Ophrah. This is at verse 11 in chapter 6. And Gideon, son of Joash, was threshing wheat at the bottom of a winepress to hide the grain from the Midianites. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him and said, mighty hero, the Lord is with you. And Gideon says so kindly, if God is with us, why is all this happening to us? And where are all the miracles our ancestors told us about? Didn't they say God has done all this stuff, but now God has abandoned us? And then the Lord turns to him and says, go with the strength you have and rescue Israel from the Midianites. I am sending you. But Lord, Gideon replied, how can I rescue Israel? My clan is the weakest in the whole tribe of Manasseh, and I am the least in my entire family. And the Lord said to him, I will be with you, and you will destroy the Midianites as if you were fighting against one man. This is a powerful encounter that Gideon has. And What has to happen in Gideon's life is he has to go from a survivor posture to an advanced posture. He has to shift what he's doing and how he's actually even viewing life. And when we capture Gideon here, he's just surviving. That's what he's doing. And he's doing the very best he can under oppression. And all he's trying to do is keep enough. You can tell he's just trying to get this food to his family, right? He's just trying to get enough. It's a survivor posture. And actually, this comes upon us all the time, especially if you're in the trenches and you're in the ground. We move into survivor posture like nothing, especially if you come from a survivor posture. If I can just get enough for me and my own, if we can just make it happen, if we can just look after my pack right here, then we'll be okay. And Gideon's in this survivor posture. And many of us get into this place. And the Lord interrupts that posture with something else. And he interrupts it with a word about who Gideon is. And this is what I want to tell you over and over and over and over again. It's about identity. Over and over again, the real war is won knowing who you are. The real war is always won with this. Every single time God interrupts people in survivor mode or in oppression mode, it's always with the word of identity. This is who you really are. He says, don't let the enemy fool you. Don't let oppression fool you. Don't let hardness fool you. Don't let surviving fool you. This is actually who you really are. And God interrupts Gideon with this word of identity. Now, what happens is Gideon then says, show me a sign, and he does all this kind of stuff. I've always been really, really hard on Gideon. I always say, you know, that's God's fault for picking men all the time, because it's always like, show me a sign and then do this. And then he sets up this offering and he puts the meat on, then fire consumes the offering from the rock, and then angel appears and Gideon's like, I'm going to die. And then he's like, okay, I'm going to put a fleece out now. You know, like you're just like, oh my gosh, just like fire just came down from heaven and consumed, like that should be enough, should it not? Like, I mean, how many signs does one guy need? You know what I'm saying? But something happens. This beautiful verse, it says, verse 23 and 24, it says, 23, it says, it's all right, God replies, do not be afraid, you will not die. And Gideon built an altar to the Lord there and named it, the Lord is peace, Yahweh Shalom. And then that night, the Lord says to Gideon, it's time for war. And that's always surprised me a little bit, that Gideon builds an altar to the God of peace right before he declares war. It's this incredible thing, isn't it? This God of peace, which actually we understand is Yahweh Shalom, right? Which is not peace as in the absence of conflict, but peace, like Martin Luther King Jr. said, which is the presence of justice in the world, right? Which is the presence of God in the world, which is all things being made the way they were supposed to be, actually. Which God coming saying, actually, things are going to be turned right upside down because this is not the way I designed humanity to live. And so it's the presence of God right before Gideon, right before he declares war, and he literally begins to advance. And the first thing he advances is idolatry, which we'll get to in 1 second. But when before he does that, before he can fight outwardly, he has got to understand Yahweh Shalom. He's got to be rooted. You know, when you talk about the armor of God and you outfit yourself for the fight, you know, what goes on your feet? Do you remember? Yeah, boots of the gospel of peace, which is also weird. What soldier fights with boots of the gospel of peace on? You know, peace, take that, right? Like, it's like, it's craziness. It's all like aggressive. Then we get to peace. But actually, shalom, the rightness of God in the world, the rootedness of knowing who you are, and the rootedness of knowing who God is, that gives you a security, that gives you a sense of strength, that gives you something to stand on when actually everything looks like it might be falling apart. There's some place like peace, like shalom, is like, I feel like it's like a steel rod that goes through every warrior, that roots them into a place where they can't be shaken, right? Where they don't even need to turn to the left, they don't need to turn to the right, because they're actually rooted and established in who they are and who God is. And those really, I believe, are the two kind of foundational things that Gideon, to shift Gideon's posture from survivor to advance and to keep him in that place, there are two things happening. One's true humility and the other's true dependency. I think these are the keys to shalom in your life, and these are the keys of a posture before you advance. Now, true humility, best definition I know of that is agreeing with God about who you are. True humility is agreeing with God about who you are. And this is where Gideon gets that word from the God. He gets a word from, you're a mighty hero. And Gideon, if you're paying attention, he says, no, I'm not. No, I'm not. He says, I am not that. That is not who I am. And the Lord says, no, mighty hero, the God is with you. You know, like, and Gideon has the exact opposite view of himself is what God says. And what Gideon has to do is reposture his life to agree with God. Because sometimes we don't feel that good about ourselves. Sometimes we don't agree with God about ourselves. Sometimes we actually have been believing lies, systemic lies that have been told us generationally. You know, I always have this picture because Gideon, what he does when God speaks to him is he starts the tape. I call it the tape. We all have a tape. We played it for our whole lives usually. It's this tape that goes on. I can picture Gideon as a kid and he's getting beat up by a Midianite at school. You know, and he's in class and he's getting all rumbled up and stuff and he's sitting around with his brothers and he just says, that's it. Today's the day. You know, I'm gonna make it right. You know, this is terrible. I don't want to deal with this anymore. And his mother comes along and says, oh, Gideon, honey. But we're the weakest tribe and you're the smallest member. And it plays like a tape, doesn't it? He plays it. Literally, when God comes and interrupts that, he plays the tape. You can hear it. But how will this ever happen, he says, because my family is the weakest tribe in all of Israel, and I'm the smallest member. And I think some of us, all of us probably, struggle with these tape that comes. Whenever God calls us to something, we have this tape we play, the reasons why we can't. And almost every time that tape is linked to our identity, is who other people have said we are. Or what we believed about other people think about us. Or why we think we can't do this. This tape plays all the time. And one of the great things in humility, one of the great posture shifts is to stop the tape and let God speak the truth to us. And the other thing that happens is Gideon has to foster dependency. Now, I used to be really hard on Gideon for all the signs, but what I realized that Gideon was actually doing was he was creating true dependency in his life. In other words, he was creating places where only God could show up. Now, in many of you, when you're in hard places and when you choose this kind of life, that's what you're doing. You are creating places in your everyday life where only God can show up. And that will create a posture of dependency. And true dependency is agreeing with God about who he is. If we can come into agreement with God about who we are, instead of what other people think of us or other people say or what we've been told our whole entire lives or whatever that tape is that we play, we come into agreement. We've got this firm footing on shalom, on the way things should be, the way thing God has designed things to be. And if we can actually come into agreement about who God is, now you see Gideon, if he had known his stories really well from the Bible, he would have known that those words, the Lord will be with you, are the words. they're the ones that always start a change in the world. Whatever God comes and says, I got this. I'm inviting you to partner with me. And everybody says, how will I do this? And God says, oh, I'll be with you. That's like, that's the ticket. That's like the golden ticket. That's like, that's the thing. That's it right there. That's enough. You've got this. But Gideon doesn't quite know that, but he's getting to know that because he's creating. Now, in our lives, what happens is we live on these continuums. I believe all the time we live in a continuum. So on the humility continuum, we live in ego land. We live in this like self-sufficient Captain America stance. I got this. Watch me, I'll just shine, right? Like if I just fix this and I can shine this thing out and I can use my all my natural gifts, I got this thing. It's self-sufficiency. Some of us live there and some of us visit there a fair bit, and we actually have to come back into posture, back into true humility, which is agreeing with what God says about who I am. Some of us live in I suck land. That's where Gideon lived, right? Where we just like nothing, we can't do it. We're so bad. We can't, and we just live in this. Many, many women I know live here. They live in a thing, and Christian women live in a thing called false humility all the time. I couldn't possibly, no, not me. No, really, please, somebody else. Because we think it's prideful to come into agreement with. I spent years and years and years apologizing for giftedness until I realized the Lord wasn't happy about that. Until I realized I needed to come into agreement about what God said about me. And so some of you are living in I suck land, need to stop that tape and come into a posture where you say, actually, this is what God says. He made me a hero. I'm a child. I'm forgiven. I've got stuff to do. I have these gifts that are for his kingdom. I've got this reason to come out a survivor. It's not just enough to get my own life together. I've got to actually get on with this thing. And then the other thing is dependency. And dependency, same thing. Self-sufficiency or independence. Severe independence. I struggle with severe independence. I got this. Thanks anyway. Thanks for your help. I got this one, you know, like it's all control tendency people. Just put up your hand. You know, like we got this. We'll sort this out. We can make this work, you know, and it's independence. And we actually have to come make a journey to dependency to create places in our life where we say, actually, I don't have this. I need you, God. I need you to show up again. I need you to do this in my life. And those of us at the very other end of that spectrum are codependent. You know, we got to have someone to go to the bathroom with. Right? We couldn't possibly pray without somebody organizing a prayer meeting. You know, God forbid we could actually, you know, an outreach program where it's just us going on. You know, we're codependent. We always need somebody with us. We can't step out and do what it is that God's called us to do. And in life, I believe that this posture shifts all the time. I think it's helpful to do this all the time is to say, am I living in true humility? Because oftentimes when I get into survivor mode, I know something's off. I know that either I'm like going like all crazy egotistical and I've got this and everything depends on me and I'm holding everything, or I've gone all like I suck and I can't do anything and I need to come back into agreement with God about what he says about me. I need to get some true humility. It'll ground me and root me in an advanced posture instead of a survivor mode. And then in the dependency department, sometimes when I've got this thing and I'm independent and I don't need anybody's help, thank you very much. I'm out of control. And when I'm in this place where I like can't do anything without a partner or an agreement or, you know, somebody holding my hand, I got to come back into a posture mode where I say, God, I'm going to agree with you about who you say you are. Those keys are getting us to the place where we could be retired Swedish commissioners who can move heaven and earth. Where we don't need to be concerned about what other people think about us anymore. We don't have to be paralyzed by what might happen if it doesn't succeed. We don't have to be paralyzed by God might not show up. We don't have to be paralyzed or if I don't get it right, it won't work. I mean, those things are paralyzing, aren't they? And they keep us in the survivor posture. If we can get to a place of Yahweh Shalom in our own lives, it's an advanced posture. And then the advance begins. The first thing that God tells Gideon to do is to destroy the idols in his own house. The strong places, the high places. Now, I told you, those of you who are here heard the story about flour. I told you that story about flour. It's a Tony Campolo story, I call it. You know, it's a happy ever ending story. It's ta-da! And then she was saved. And then she was brought into a family and wreaked havoc, and we dealt with her multiple personality disorder and tried to detox her from drugs, and then she, you know, just caused chaos wherever she went for years and years, actually. And then she had, you know, some deliverance and some, you know, I'm pretty sure we delivered a few personalities and we counseled a few demons, but whatever. We tried to sort that stuff out, and, you know, it was this long and long and long laborsome journey, but she did get free. She actually lives in England now, and she, even all of her track marks went away, you know, like she had surgery, and she, you can't tell now that she was ever a drug addict. She's just, it is a transformation. And the other day she phoned me up, and a couple months ago she phoned me up, and she said, I saw you on this TV program. She said, I saw an interview of you. She phoned me up. She goes, you're never going to guess. I saw you on TV. You know, I said, oh, well, that's nice. And she said, yeah, it was interesting. It was interesting. Now, I had just been to see the movie Hercules. Has anyone seen the new Hercules movie? It's with Dwayne Johnson, so Hercules is in fine form. Let me just say that. And that's enough said. And the idea of this new Hercules is that Hercules is like, you know, this myth that's been created, of course, to get more jobs, right? So it's Hercules has a whole team behind him. And the team kind of, so when he goes into these like crazy battles that not one man could ever do alone, not one man has ever done it alone. He actually has the secret team that goes in and does it. And then Hercules emerges as the hero. And there's a few reasons, of course, that you create myths. And one is kind of to invoke fear in the enemy when Hercules is on your, and the other is to actually get a job as a fighter. You know, that's one of the elements, and to bolster the troops, right? We've got Hercules. We can't lose, you know, that kind of thing. And there's this scene in Hercules where he goes out, he's fighting in the battle, and he's got this big red cape on, you know, and he's fighting, and one of the other soldiers that he's just normal soldier, he's fighting with, cuts his shoulder, you know, and he's got some blood pouring down, and the captain of Hercules' team comes running over, and he's like through the battle line, the front line battle, he's on a horse, and he's dodging all these things, he's dodging, and he gets up to Hercules, and he whispers in his ear, he takes the red cape that Hercules is wearing, and he covers his wound, and he says this, never let them see you bleed. Never let them see you bleed. And instantly when I saw that, I had this image flash, like in the movies. I just, boom, I saw Jesus bleeding everywhere. I just saw his blood everywhere, like him naked and vulnerable and exposed for the whole world to see forever. I mean, it even still bugs us if you're Protestant to go to a Catholic church and see him bloodied like that. We're just like, clean it up. Jesus was raised from the dead. Put that away. That was this moment, like, put it away. We're always like, ah, blood. You know, just like, ew, yuck, weakness, like vulnerability, like, ah, shame, like, ah, put it away, you know. And I just that never let them see you bleed, I think is just one of the greatest idols of our culture. It's one of the greatest idols of our culture that we bring into the church all the time. Type A leaders, right? There's got to be a Hercules. And Flowers, she's talking to me on the phone, and she says, I just saw this interview with me. She said, it just occurred, I just had this thought out of nowhere. She said, this was just absolutely incredible. She said, I'm in the middle of this, I'm watching this interview with you. And she goes, just this thought came to me. I said, look, just spit it out. What was it? She said, well, it's just so crazy. She said, it's just totally crazy. Just came out of nowhere. I said, what was it? And she said, well, this thought came to me. She said, I just had this thought, like, you're a human. She said, like, you're a real human being. Like, you have, like, feelings and stuff. Like, I just had this thought, she said. Like, I was thinking back, and I was thinking, wow, like, that must have been hard for you. And I was thinking about it, you know, I felt the Holy Spirit just come in his beautiful, rebuking way and say, never let them see you bleed. Never let them see you bleed. And what I realized is that I had bought into idolatry, right? I had bought into the myth that there was such a thing as I've got this. What I realized is that I had contributed to that. What I realized is that I missed out on the opportunity of really being Jesus to Flower. I missed it, because what I should have done, if I could reverse time, if I could go back, and actually now I'm trying to do this a different way, but if I could go back, what I would say is, it's not okay, actually, this is killing me. What I would say is, ouch, I'd say it a lot more. What I would say to flowers, like, flower, I struggle too. Like, my whole family comes out of addiction. As a matter of fact, when I get tired and I get fearful and I get weary, I have a tendency to want to drink. And if I actually start to drink, I'm not going to stop. That's what happens. So why don't you come with me to an AA meeting? Why don't you come with me and we'll recover together? Like, why don't we do this thing together? Actually, when I get afraid and when I get tired, my schedule gets in, I'm on the road or whatever, like, I can actually just check out and I can be emotionally unavailable to my family and I can, my marriage can suffer for that. And I can have a perceived good one, but actually a shallow one if I'm honest with myself. And you should be aware of that too, because if you shut down, that'll happen to you too. Why don't we do this together? But I was too busy with a red cape being Captain America. That's idolatry, isn't it? And what Gideon has to do, and this is a remarkable thing because it's actually how the advance happens in the church. This is how we advance the kingdom, is to tear down the high places. It's to take down things like status. It's to tear down things like celebrity. It's to tear down things that are actually cultural idolatry things, but to say that's actually not how we're going to lead. And listen, Gideon is going to do some incredible things, but he's not going to do them as Hercules. And the people, you know, what's really interesting about this, when he tears down those high places, those valuable places, those really valuable, I mean, it is literally losing, like, this is his father's inheritance. This is everything these people have. And they're oppressed, so they don't have much. And Gideon cuts it down and burns it as an offering. I mean, holy cow, no wonder they wanted to kill him. And can you think of the things that you've cut down and burned as offerings to God? Inheritances that you should have had? And why it's so offensive? I mean, I don't know if this happens to you, but whenever I posture myself a different way, people get really offended. People get really offended when you throw money away. When you say that success isn't enticing to me. When you say to the inheritance, thanks anyway. I remember convincing my husband that everybody should just give everything away. And if we have stuff in our bank account, it's probably not good. Because then we'll be like, when Jesus comes back, we'll be like, oh shoot, we could have used that for the kingdom, you know. And I convinced him of that because all I had to my name was like a ghetto blaster. But he came from a whole lineage of money and he had a massive inheritance. And we had this big conversation. Of course, I'm going to marry him. He was just my fiancé at the time. And he was like, actually, I think I agree with you. And he gave away his inheritance. And his dad hates me to this day. He said, I think you're right. This is crazy. This could all be used for the kingdom. He just started giving away tens of thousands of dollars. I was like, no, I didn't mean like for you to give it away. I just meant like my ghetto blaster. You know what I'm saying? That's all I meant. And every time we meet with his family, you know, his dad just goes on and on and on about money. Money. How irresponsible he is as a father. How terrible it is for his kids, you know. What's he going to do in the end? How he gave it all away. You know, like just over and over again. It's like when you tear down high places in your culture and in your own family, it's painful. It's really, really painful. It's really, really difficult. And that's what you're doing even in society. When you throw away, I remember a couple came to join us. He was a revered youth leader. He had all these, he had degrees from, and he felt the Lord. He felt God say, I'm supposed to come join you. We had no money. We had no way to hire him or anything. So his wife worked in a bakery and he came and worked for free. I remember they lived in this little slum rooming house in the downtown east side of Vancouver. And his parents were just like, what? And the Salvation Army, he was like a golden boy. They were like, what? You're ruining all that talent. You're losing. You're just giving away all these possibilities of a successful ministry. And we were just like, yeah, isn't it awesome? Isn't it great? Because God wants to raise up Gideons, right, who are free from the culture, who are willing to tear down the high places, who are willing to say, you know what? I'm not perfect. I'm not some silly celebrity. That's some red cape that people want to put on people so for some sort of myth-like possibility that there's somebody who has it together somewhere that can do everything right. Good luck with that. That's from the movies, man. There's just real people who come into agreement with God about who they are, And they don't have to be better than they are. They don't have to pretend to be something they're not. They just have to come into agreement with God about who He is too. And when they're in that place of shalom, then they can start tearing high places down. They don't have to hide anymore. They don't have to be afraid anymore. Will it be difficult? Absolutely. Will people want to kill you? Definitely your father-in-law. But what will it do? It'll free you. It'll free you to trust God. Then God begins the most miraculous battle scene in the history of the world. They enter in, Gideon comes in, and he's got this, finally he roused the entire army. He's got everybody ready to go. And God says, oh, this isn't going to work. You have way too many people. What? He says, send everybody who's afraid home. And 22,000 of them leave. That'll bolster some faith. Only 10,000 were willing to fight. Listen, but the Lord told Gideon, there's still too many. Get rid of some more until there's only 300. And Gideon takes on a whole Midianite army with 300 men. How could he do it? How could he get there? How could he believe God? Because he had Yahweh Shalom. Because he understood some stuff. Some things had been sorted before this battle. Some things that he could understand before this battle happened. Before that massive advance can happen, these things happen. Humility and dependency, Yahweh Shalom. When we understand who we are and we understand who God is. And that, my friends, is freedom. That is authority. That is the ability to advance. That is idol smashing beauty. That is good news to the world. That is warriors who are going to win the world for Jesus. I'm going to pray for you and then leave you to adjust, make your adjustments. This is in my own experience. There's not one adjustment. There's all the time adjustments coming back into posture again. Some of you may have forgotten what God says about you. You're too busy worried about what other people say. Some of you may have forgotten who He is and you're thinking, I've heard about you, but where are you? Where are you? Where are you? Just like Gideon said, and God says, I'm right with you. And you need to come back into alignment. Some of you struggling with codependency need to get into God and believe Him and do what He says no matter what. Some of you who struggle with independence need to come into community. On and on it goes. Some adjustments need to be made for warriors to be ready to advance. So God, we thank You so much for You being Yahweh Shalom. Thank You that You are our peace. Thank You that You speak to us about who we are. Thank You that that doesn't have to be something special. It could just be who we are. Thank You for making us. Thank You for calling us. Thank You for moving us from survivor mode into advance mode. Would You please make whatever adjustments You need to make in our hearts, in our minds, in our communities, in our teams? Would You please bring us into alignment? Would You please fit our feet with readiness that comes from the gospel of peace? Would You please help us not to fight out of insecurity or fear? Help us not to advance out of some point to make. But give us that posture. Be shalom to us. Be the rightness of Yourself in us, in our communities. And then would You use us, oh so powerfully, would You use us as a spectacle? The weakest of us, please use us to confound the strong. Would You use us so the whole world would know that this thing is about You, not about us.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to check out message.org.uk to find out how you can support or even get involved with one of our teams.